you're bound and dying when dying time is here. Just bundle up my coffin, cause it's cold way down there. I hear that it's cold way down there, yeah. Crazy cold way down there. And when I die and when I'm gone, there'll be one child born in a world to carry, carry on.
You've just heard Lauren Nero, poet, composer, singer. Many of you, not for the first time. I'm John Daly. Welcome to an hour with this talented young artist who has been compared by some critics to such leading song stylists as Aretha Franklin, Diana Ross, and Barbara Streisand. Lauren Nero is a New York girl, born and raised in the Bronx, where she was influenced by the music and sounds of the city, rhythm and blues, soul music, and as someone has termed it, street gospel. Her first songs were written when she was 11, songs about animals, experiences, and nonsense verse. Miss Nero then began to rewrite the lyrics of popular songs, but finally she returned to composing her own, drawing freely on personal experiences with people, God, the devil, and love for subject, enfolding all in a musical combination of the sounds from her childhood and the moods, rhythms, and images of the city. Miss Nero sings several of her compositions from an album entitled New York Tenderberry and defines her music and her sound. Our critics are Michael Thomas and Patrick O'Connor. Now, Miss Lauren Nero.
The time be near. If it's peace you find in dying, when dying time is here. Just bundle up my coffin, cause it's cold way down there. I hear that it's cold way down there, yeah. Crazy cold way down there. And when I die and when I'm gone, there'll be one child born and a world to carry, carry on. My troubles are many, they're as deep as the well. I can swear there ain't no heaven, and I pray there ain't no hell. Swear there ain't no heaven, I pray there ain't no hell. But I'll never know by living, only my dying will tell. Said only my dying will tell you, only my dying will tell. And when I die and when I'm gone, there'll be one child born and a world to carry, carry on. Is to have no chains on me. All I ask of living is to have no chains on me. And all I ask of dying is to go naturally. Only wanna go naturally. Don't wanna go by the devil. Don't wanna go by the demon. Don't wanna go by Satan. Don't wanna die uneasy. And when I die and when I'm gone, there'll be one child born and a world to carry. When I
there's a man who loves me when my hair is tied, when my hair is down, when I touch the man. don't you know?
And there you have the sound of Miss Laura Nero, and you'll hear more from Miss Nero later. Joining us to talk about her as a composer and a performer are Michael Thomas, novelist, writer, critic, and contributor to Holiday, Ramparts, and I magazines, and Patrick O'Connor, senior editor for the New American Library and critic for the Jersey Journal. Now, Mr. Thomas, I'd like to start with you and ask a blunt question for a man who's over 50 and isn't quite used to the sounds of these days. Are the sounds of Laura Nero indicative of the 1960s, or do they harken back to earlier times also?
Well, I wouldn't say she's very indicative of anything much but herself. She's, the thing that's very special about her is Right now, rock and roll has become very decadent and very jaded and very repetitive, and a question of people trying to outdo each other, pretty much doing the same thing. She's the first person since the Beatles to really do anything that's strictly personal and strictly sensual and strictly and it's weird because it's like street music, and it's very earthy, and it's very dirty, and it's very low, and it's very mean, you know. And it's also very it's sluttish almost, you know. And yet it's also she's what she's concerned with is something completely different. She's concerned with a whole funny kind of Catholic mystery to do with the body there's constantly throughout her songs, the songs are about God or the devil and things in between, and she strikes
many themes with which we all grew up and which in literature and in song from days long before we got here are familiar to us. Mr. O'Connor, don't you find that you and I share not the same years, but you, I think, having come in a good deal after I did, but don't you find much particularly of the combination of sound and lyric here, the sound that is reminiscent of the past?
What I resent bitterly about people of my age is how we were cheated by the composers of our days, except perhaps for Cole Porter and Larry Hart, Gershwin. But the rest of the pap we listened to in the 30s and the 40s, totally irrelevant, had nothing to do with our lives. I don't mean just the June Moon School. I mean Sammy Fain and Sammy Cunningham. They're all called Sammy. Yeah. And they wrote those dreadful songs, and we listened to them. And now, in the 60s, the songs have meaning. They are related to the lives of the people who are singing them. The songs we listened to were about a world we didn't know. These songs are about their world, the world of the street. 16-year-old kids know a great deal.
But can I ask one question? Isn't it also true, though, in pragmatic terms, that there's a good deal of trash being written today, even in the modern song, that is hardly worth listening?
No, I don't think so.
But now, you take. If I may, I'm going to call you both Pat and Mike. As an Irishman, they've never had an opportunity like this in recent years, so I will. But actually, Mike made the point, for instance, that there was a constant repetition growing in what we call rock music. I found this out of my experience and time upon this globe, this repetition, the constant repetition of simple ideas without any really poetic substance.
But
to
rock and roll
annoying.
Is simple ideas. Rock and roll is simple ideas. Rock and roll isn't an art form. You know, it's funny. It should be fun. Rock and roll used to be fun. You know, before the Beatles took a lot of dope and made the Sgt. Pepper album. And everybody got off on that and decided, and got into electronics and got into the symphonic rock and roll and got to awfully pretentious.
Well, now, Mike, where did rock and roll begin? It didn't begin with the Beatles, right?
No, it didn't begin with the Beatles. It began with the sort of songs you're talking about, actually. It began with Moon.
Well, with rhythm and blues, with the underground blues. Music of the 30s and earlier.
It also began in country music, and also began in, like, American pop song, you know, American popular romantic lyrical, to me, lovely. You know, I love the songs that you just put down. You know, and I like to listen to them. And then it got during the 50s when people from the South, like Presley and the Everly Brothers, who are probably still the best rock and roll singers, certainly the Everly Brothers, I would think, are. And then for the first exposure of black performance on wide media or extensive media. That's where it began. And she's very into rhythm and blues, certainly, and she's very into black music, you know, and a lot of it reeks of that kind of music. You know.
But isn't this issue, for instance, of high rhythm? We knew it in our younger days. I never can remember the names of songs. Do you remember the thing that went Beat Your Feet in the Mississippi Mud? I can remember we played that in prep school.
No, those weren't popular songs of the day. Those were classic songs. They were. You had to be very hip and very aware to be listening to songs like On the Mississippi Mud.
But I went to a little prep school in New Hampshire, and I can remember clearly, because I heard it so much, that this probably was one of the most popular songs of the day, Beat Your Feet in the Mississippi Mud. And then there was something that Goodman, you had two or three records that rhythmically were magnificent and which aroused you emotionally simply in the process of listening. Now, is this a refinement of
that? There was good music being written at the time, you know, and the Goodman records are great. They're swing, what we call swing, or jazz, white jazz, you know.
But is beat music or rock music a modification of what I knew as a boy as good rhythm music?
Yes.
Or is it a different form?
No, it's an outgrowth.
It's more primitive, you know. It's much more primitive than the music you heard as a boy, I think.
Yeah,
good rock
agree.
And roll is very primitive and very sensual. And Laura Nero is certainly very sensual. But then she's also very sophisticated rhythmically, you know. I mean, more sophisticated than anybody writing songs nowadays, I think. And you'll notice that the songs go through all kinds of different rhythms and so forth, and all kinds of different moods. You know, they're very much like little mock situational epic songs. You know, and they're all very personal. You know, embarrassingly personal sometimes, suicidal sometimes. You know.
Well, let me ask both of you, and I'll start with you, if I may, Mr. O'Connor. Do you find Laura Nero wanting in any substantial degree as a performing artist, considering her youth and the fact that she's what, been 4 or 5 years, I guess, in the process of growing?
No, I think, as Michael said, that she's the best thing I've heard since the Beatles. Mm. She really...
She's better than the Beatles, probably.
Yeah, she's better than the Beatles. And she has that freedom. Those wonderful nonsense verses remind me of Gertrude Stein, remind me of Four Saints in Three Acts, you know, Pigeons on the Grass Alas. What do her lyrics mean? Her lyrics don't mean anything.
What's the rest
Pigeons
of it?
On the grass, alas.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back. I'm going to stay with the sound for a minute because it's the sound that worries me. Let me go to something again. See, I'm the devil's advocate here,
sure.
And I'm ununderstanding. I think very probably it's true that people in the over 50 bracket, as I am, are wanting in our understanding of modern sounds. When I was in school, for instance, we all had great respect for the bass player. And the bass player was basically the beat. As I examine what is happening today, I often ask myself if the bass player has not been put stage front and center and they put 6 microphones around him and that he is getting an emphasis which we wouldn't have thought proper in my day because that the beat was really to be a sort of a carrier upon which the modulations...
It's very important that rock and roll be improper, though, I think. I mean, I think good rock and roll must be... must upset all this, any kind of symmetry, any kind of nice orchestral symmetry, you know. And what comes out front, I think, what comes out front in Laura's case, because she's one girl singing with a piano, is obviously a girl singing with a piano.
Well, moving into the classical field, is Miss Nero as much of a, I hate to use the word these days because it's becoming a cliche, a revolutionary in the sense that, for instance, Cage is in the classical field?
Yes. Her rhythms, if you listen to them carefully, are much more complicated than the rock rhythm. The rhythm changes every... 6 bars, 8 bars. It takes some careful listening. She can't relate her to Cage or people like that, although there's an unconscious influence there. But she doesn't stick with the beat. It changes all the time, and it's very exciting.
Mm.
And you have to pay attention very carefully, as though you were listening to Mozart, I think.
Now, is there the faithfulness to... I'm going to get myself in trouble. I can smell it from miles away. Is there a faithfulness to the traditions of harmonics and composition, for instance, as they've come up from Mozart?
No, those have been exploded.
They're just thrown out of the...
Thrown out. There's no reason for them anymore. No. In that sense, Cage has had an influence.
Mm-hmm.
What she does is very correct because it's she's working within her own... you know, it's very much a side trip off what's going on. You know, I mean, what's going on is becoming very flaccid. And I've been listening to rock and roll since I was, you know, 10 years old and I first heard Elvis Presley, and I've been listening to it solid since then.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten more and more tired of it, you know. And very rarely does anything excite me anything like as much as she does, and she certainly excites me.
You can relate her to Ives. You know how Ives uses collage, the snatches of rhythms, various rhythms, and she's very much part of that tradition.
None of this is conscious, though. I don't think on her part. I mean, none of it is studied. I mean, there's nothing, very little that's studied about what she does. You know?
Well, are you suggesting there, Mike, that in the process of composition, it is almost more or less improvisation as you go along?
I think a lot of it, I assume, and I've been at her house sometimes when she's been singing, you know, a lot of it does seem to me to suggest itself, you know, and to suggest the next thing, and in that sense be improvisational, certainly. Yeah.
Well, let's find out a bit more about Laura Nero. Her music, all of which she writes, arranges, and sings, as you know, to her own accompaniment, has been called rock, jazz, and soul, I guess, are the three elements that cover it. 2 of her works, by the way, have been recorded by a popular group, the Fifth Dimension. And both of these pieces, Stoned Soul Picnic and Sweet Blindness, indicate that her music is beginning to reach larger audiences. Now Miss Nero discusses her work with William Cloman, freelance writer for Esquire magazine and the Sunday New York Times.
There's a feeling about the music that it's very personal. And maybe this is a trend in the arts generally, for people to put a lot of themselves into their work. Does this make sense in terms of the way you work?
Yeah, yeah. Because I could only speak for myself anyway. But, I didn't think you start off planning to write a personal song. I never did it. I was never even conscious of it, you know, that I was sitting down and writing a personal song.
Where does it begin?
Well, it's like a labor, you know. It's a very special labor. And it's always worth it at the end, you know. It's a good, good feeling. It's a good labor. And it's like, I don't know, sometimes like I just be feeling, going through something emotional and unable to know what it is, you know, like I just don't know what it is, and then I just sit down and there's a song there that's coming from, you know, from inside me. And
it comes from pain?
Yeah, it comes from pain, and usually it comes from pain. And sometimes, you know, a lot of times it comes from a joy that's so joyful that even it's painful, you know. But, you know, it comes... It's usually never middle of the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I
and the feeling is extreme, whether it's extreme joy or,
yeah,
or pain.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you start doing this when you were little?
Yeah, when I was about... I don't know, a baby. You know, I would sing and then when I was a little girl, I wrote poetry, and you know, like when I was 5 years old, I played the piano, and you know, from that time, it just became a thing, you know, and it was my little world.
It's like creating your own world.
Yeah, kind of. I didn't know, you know, I remember, like, as a child, being in my parents' house, and, like, sometimes I'd just be in my room totally tuned out or totally tuned in, you know, tuned in to my own thing, because in my world, I could look at my pain, and it wasn't ugly to me. It was a matter of understanding it, and channeling it, you know, into a beautiful thing. And because I think pain is something that can do two things to a person. I think it can sometimes shatter a person, destroy them, or they can grow from their pain. They can become a greater person, I believe, from their pain, because, you know, it's just that, you know. And
does the growth if you're to grow, do you have to make something with it? I mean, you can make it into songs.
Yeah, but not only songs, not only that. I mean, it just can penetrate you, you know. It just penetrate a human being, you know, and it also has to do with your communication with people after that, you know. I think that you understand more, you know, because I really feel that, you know, pain can do those two things, you know.
And if you're creating, or if your work involves the openness to the experience, do you ever find that this is a difficulty, that you seek certain kinds of experience in order to create something from them? I mean, it's a Well, strange question to ask an artist, but that's...
I suppose that it's a little bit of that, you know. It's a little bit of that. Because, like, sometimes, you know, like, if I meet a man or something who's very groovy, I say, oh, he's very good material.
He's an album.
And that's terrible. That sounds terrible. But it's a natural thing, you know. It does. I reflect, you know. I reflect on things, you know, and what I feel, you know. It's the most honest part of me.
And what about influences? Not influences, but so much people who've maybe see the world the same way you do. Other people that you like learned to see the world through when you were a child.
Well, I'm sure that, you know, that I see the world through, you know, through my eyes, and I think that I see things differently than most people. I think so, you know, because I remember in school, you know, I hated school, and when the teacher, like, she used to talk to me, I wouldn't really be hearing what she was saying, but I would be looking into her eyes and trying to, you know, and getting into a sensory thing, you know. And
seeing the world through your senses.
Yeah, yeah, right, yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Here with me is David Geffen, who's head of the music division of Ashley Famous Agency, which handles many young performers. And David, if I may use your first name, I think as interesting to many of us as the talent that Miss Nero has already displayed is the process by which you select out of the many the one who will be given an opportunity, really, to meet an audience and in the process grow in fame and, in, I trust, in the skills of her particular talent. Suppose you tell us the story of Miss Nero.
Well, it's not a problem because there are so few great talents that it's always a discovery when you find the one. There are so many people around who are trying to make it in the music business. It's a very open business, more open, I think, than any other area of show business. With Laura, I didn't discover her. I was in California, and she had a record that was being played quite a bit. And I heard the record, and I loved it. And I went out and bought the album and listened to it, and I was stunned at all the insight that she had. You know, she was, at the time, I think, 19 years old, and it was overwhelming. It was more of an experience than I had ever had listening to an artist. And I got back to New York. I tried to track her down, and I called up her manager, the man who was handling her at the time, and I said, "Your client is unbelievable." And he proceeded to put her down terribly, you know. And I thought to myself, "How awful that this poor girl was, you know, being managed by someone who had no respect for her at all." And I finally got to meet her. And she was very innocent, very, very innocent young girl who really couldn't take care of herself. All she could do was create. And I told her that I wanted to help her, and she needed help. And we got together, and I've been her agent since then. She's a very special person. She's very much a woman, and yet she's incredibly a child, incapable of driving or, you know, just makes beautiful music and has a great deal of wisdom.
Well, now, when you first met Miss Nero, she had arrived at some public identification. Was she known broadly or basically, say, among the aficionados of soul music or rock or whatever you would call it? Or was there a need to begin almost all over again and make an introduction to the audience? And
yes, it was, because her initial start in this business had been handled by people who had no sensitivity at all, and they had led her in all the wrong directions. I remember she was telling a story of the first time that she appeared anywhere. They had her booked on an aircraft carrier with 60,000 drunken sailors, and she followed
him. I am an old retired naval officer, David. Now, would you like to rephrase that? She was on an aircraft carrier and what? 60,000 nice young men. Yes, go.
And
she was
following a roller skating act, and they wouldn't let her sing live. They had her, and she's a great singer. They had her mouth lip sync to a record, and in the middle of the record, it started skipping. You know, there was just no protection, you know, no care for her as a person or an artist. And this first album that she'd recorded was also, again, with no care. All the care that she'd put into creating the material was then handled with no care by the people who were going to lay it down on tape, and it was an inferior product for her. Not that
you mean in terms of sound production or in terms of what?
She writes marvelous lyric musical changes, and her arranger didn't think that they were commercial. She doesn't know what commercial means. She only knows what she feels, so they would write out her changes, things that she labored on for months and months and months, and they would just take them out. And she used to go in and listen to the tracks that they had made out of her music, and she would cry. You know, she would just cry, and they used to think she was crazy. You know, here she was crying all the time. And then they would give her, one or two opportunities to sing the song, and she was going for something that was beautiful, something that was personal and beautiful to her. And they were just looking to sell records, you know, and that was not what her intention is. It isn't today. As a matter of fact, it's very difficult to get her to do anything that might further her, you know, her career in the business, so to speak. She won't do television shows for the most part. She never has. She doesn't go on the road. All she wants to do is do a personal creative thing. Although she'll start now because she wants to perform. It's part of the whole talent. But now when she'll perform... surrounded by people who are interested in what she's doing, not looking for her to do something else.
Now, as one who has tried to understand the modern sounds of music, yes. I felt certainly in the 1950s that the lyric did not have a substantial meaning or quality, or was not considered necessarily to have such, because the sound was overpowering. You very rarely could make out a word occasionally. But I've noticed in Miss Nero singing that the lyrics do play a very substantial part. Now, was this a calculated decision to change a character of music, or had Miss Nero taken up a new vogue in terms of rock and soul by giving a distinction to lyrics and the quality of the lyrics?
I think lyrics have always been important to any songwriter, any serious writer of music. From the very beginning, I think in the 50s, things that seemed simple and superfluous had some meaning. Maybe it wasn't a great meaning, it didn't shake the world, but it meant
something. What if you couldn't hear them, Dave? I never could hear the words. All I could hear the
music.
Well,
there were a lot of things that were just sounds, like shaboom, shaboom. It doesn't have a meaning, it's a feel. It's a musical feel, and if it makes you feel good, then it has a meaning. I think in Laura's case, she's trying to communicate in her songs and in her music of trials and of love and happiness and... for instance, the song Stone Soul Picnic, the lyrics are, can you surrey, can you picnic? Well, that really doesn't mean anything. She's not asking you to have a picnic, you know, per se, not literally. She's just setting up a joyful feel with the music, you know, and really hoping that you'll be joyful along with it.
Well, I'm glad you brought up that one, because I wanted to ask you if I was interpreting something here. As I remember, it begins, let me look for it here, can you surrey?
The lyrics are, can you surrey, can you picnic?
Come on,
and surrey down to a stone soul picnic.
Ah, that's not. Does this have reference to the surrey with the fringe on top? Is it a means of transportation?
No. It's a means of transportation, only in a very magical sense. It's a feel. Surrey on down is to float on down. One of the lyrics are, and from the sky come the Lord and the lightning. And that's where that particular song was at for her. For instance, her version of it is a lot happier. A lot more joyful, for instance, in the Fifth Dimensions. Theirs is, they interpreted it, you know, very literally. As a matter of fact, when they perform it, they make like a surrey with a fringe on top. One has nothing to do with the other at all. They're feels. For instance, When I Die, the song that she sang in the beginning, is a song that she wrote when she was 16 years old. And it overwhelmed me that a girl of 16 years old could say, when I die and when I'm gone, there'll be one child born in the world to carry on.
This is This is a remarkable lyric, and certainly the lyric to that particular song has a high poetical quality. I want to thank you, and I do hope, as you said, it will give you more sympathy for your performance.
Much more.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Thank you.
As you know, as one critic has described to listening to Miss Nero, quote, at first, she sounds like a soul singer. Suddenly, the listener notices that lyrics are starting to form networks, referring forward and backward as often as they proceed linearly. Sometimes she does whole lines at a single clip. Other times she shades and shapes each note. She can make her voice anything from solid to fragile. Well, she is a poet, but both the poetry and the music are of equal stature in terms of the total work. The two are inseparable. Listen particularly to the lyrics of these next two songs. Here again is Laura Nero.
Medicine's mound.
on Broadway. People in the land of shine, down and get wine. In the doom swept the band away. Baby on Broadway, is she mild? That mother and child, does she obey? Once I live under the city in my sweet
Yeah.
And now, Michael Thomas and Patrick O'Connor, let's talk a minute about the lyrics principally, and I would ask a simple question. Do you feel, for instance, Pat first, is Miss Nero a poet?
Yes. Definitely a poet. She's an urban blues poet, if I may use that expression. She's writing in that first song, which is a wonderful song, about Broadway on a hot day. You have to be a New Yorker to realize what Broadway is like on a hot day. But if you're not, she presents the picture to you. And then at one point, she says, Madison smiles. That really is potent poetry. It's wonderful. An urban blues poet, yes. It's full of potency, full of imagination and profundity, I would say.
Michael, you agree?
Hey, yes, I agree, I suppose. Whether or not she's a poet is perhaps nothing that I really want to think about too much. I think that what it is a lot of words in a row, you know, that make sense, and that make you feel good or make you feel bad, you know.
But Mike, isn't there a play?
Can I tell you a story?
Yeah.
I went to hear her make a record of this last song she sang, and I went there and it took 2 hours, and they recorded one note in 2 hours, and then they played the song. And it made me terribly sad. It made me really sad. Not just sad, personally reacted to it. It made me sad for all the cripples and all the hungry people and the guy in the subway who plays a saxophone with a tin can. And all those people. So sad that I just couldn't stay there and I had to walk outside. And I couldn't even remember what the song is about or what the lyric is. You know, a lot of the time I find myself not especially conscious of what's being said, you know, because what is happening is a much more... soulful thing than that, you know.
Well, true, Mike, but and I will agree
she's
that when you
words,
when
yeah.
you marry the words to sound that is appropriate, as is true in opera, for instance,
yeah.
The greatest moments in opera are the perfect marriage of sound and lyric. But do you feel, stripping the sound away, do you feel that the lyrics that Miss Nero writes do have a high poetic quality?
Well, I have the lyrics here, you know, before me, written mm-hmm. out, and she's not singing them, and I read it through, and they're just... not much has been said, you know. It's probably the same line repeated mostly all the way through the song. It doesn't make it as a print, you know, experience on a piece of paper, because it isn't that, you know. And I think the thing about a song is important is if you play the melody of a song and you don't hear the words, then and it makes it and it sounds good, then there's something wrong with the song, you know. And if you can read the words and enjoy them without the music, there's something wrong with the song, too. The song is not words to music. It's not words and music. It's a song, and it's a third form, you know. I think.
Yeah, but isn't the highest form of this art, really, to marry good words to appropriate sound? In other words, the sound should reflect in its way what the words are saying.
But the words
the
are
words
sounds.
Should
the
reflect
words are more important. I think the words in Laura's songs are as important as sound events,
the words are notes.
rather than as any kind of intellectual event.
Yeah, but Pat, the point I make, you know, the song we began the program with, and which we then reprised the first verse of and did all the verses. I'm not scared of dying, and I don't really care if it's peace you find in dying. Well, then let the time be near. If it's peace you find in dying, when dying time is here, just bundle up my coffin, because it's cold way down there. I hear it's cold way down there, crazy cold way down there, which is the only repetitive theme. And when I die, and when I'm gone, there'll be one child born, and a world to carry on.
Moved by that?
Terribly. I think it's poetry. This
yes.
is. Now, there are some elements of which, particularly when she gets into the local, or let's say the current patois and things sender, that I find no poetic qualities. Mm. But I'm struck with the true poetry of much of what she writes in language, and language alone. And
but
now
you
what
just,
I want
you
to
get read it as a poem and read it very nicely, you know, and,
yes.
and obviously moved by it. But
well, thanks,
how does
Mike.
That go?
That's good.
But then think about how it goes with, you know, when you hear it sung. It makes a lot more sense sung, doesn't it? And sounds even perhaps nicer.
Well,
than you're
I think this is an interesting reaction. I find that particular passage more effective as pure language than
I do
as language and music. But there are some things that she's done while we've been together here for this hour, where I found the music added a very great deal to the language, and this is what I was coming to. I think that maybe this is a talent that is unique. Certainly it's a unique talent, but that she has it in substantial.
But the new thing that Mike was talking about, bringing them all together, that they're not one plus one does not equal two. You can't strip the music away from opera libretto.
Right.
You can't do it. The words are absurd.
Mm.
But these words have a special meaning. And they do affect you, and they do move you. Fine day I'll find you. You know,
right? I was thinking of something from my day, which I think had the same qualities. When smoke gets in your eyes, the music and the language together are almost a perfect marriage to create an emotional reaction in the individual. So that
I think it's interesting that a lot of the songs that in your day, okay.
Well, let's get out of my day. Collaboration. What about the Ave?
But, I'm thinking of all the songwriters, and prior to, I think, the 60s, the songwriters were a collaboration of one man who wrote the lyric and another man who wrote the music. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen anymore. Mostly what happens now is it's done all by one person, right? And mostly what happens is that people perform almost exclusively their own material nowadays. It's very rarely that a songwriter gets as widely recorded by other people as perhaps they used to. And people don't... The songwriters do not really exist anymore, you know. They're people who perform things that they write, you know. Mm-hmm. But in the old sense of somebody sitting down and writing a song doesn't happen. Because it just doesn't make sense that way, I don't think. And I think that the what we're talking about and what this is all about is a song experience, perhaps the most... exciting song experience, stunning, astonishing song experience around right now, and if you take the lyrics of the songs, they don't follow each other in any kind of logical pattern. They don't except that there is a greater logic toward a cosmic logic maybe to it.
No, but you don't have to be cosmic, Mike. You know, and when I die, in all of its three verses, is I think a great unified whole.
Yeah,
and
but you're 16 then. I think we should think more about these last two songs anyway, because I think that's more what she's doing rather than. I think When I Die is like a good. It's like a gospel song. It's like an old spade gospel song. You know. And but this isn't. This is something else. This is much more introverted and I think scary song too.
Well, I think scary.
Somebody's
but now,
been that unhappy.
You see,
you
one
know.
Thing. I listened to the interview with great interest, and I'm not being unkind, and I don't want you to think I am being, because I'm really looking for information. Maybe it's because I'm over 50, but as I listened, I could not but help say to myself, I think she feels this and feels it very deeply, but I have heard this theme over and over again in my more than 50 years. It's coming from inside. I feel it, and it's nothing I have no power over. It sort of does it by itself. And so I don't think this is essentially new. I think this is the process
not
by
new,
which
but
the
I
great
believe
artist
it.
Is created automatically.
It's
Come on,
always,
Pat,
get it's
in
coming
this fight.
Again.
It's coming again. Yes,
it's
I
always.
So.
It's a renewal. Always it's a renewal.
I mean, the great, you know... I don't care what the art form is, in music or poetry. Let's take I raised the Ave a bit ago. Certainly glorious lyrics, whether you do them in Latin or in English. And the music adds enormously to the Ave. There are many Aves, but the one that is standard that we all know. Mm. I think she has this quality, but I would suggest to you that there is a fine poetic talent here, but it needs further training. Musically, I have no competence
to
judge
whether there
needs to be
more
musical.
How can you possibly train a poetic talent? I mean, there's no way.
Oh, you... Well,
you
I think know, you train...
You can grow and deepen.
You
deepen.
Can grow
yeah.
and deepen, yes. What I meant by
you
training
just cross
that.
Your fingers, you know, and hope that she makes it. I mean, I hope that she can keep doing it. But, you can't... There's nothing you could say... And there's no way that I could imagine saying anything to her, like... I think if you paid more attention to your rhyme scheme, I mean, you know, it doesn't make sense to talk. I don't think to talk that way about this kind of music, you know, which is finally more importantly sensual body music, heat music than it is anything that you can really. You can't bring that kind of intelligence to it, that kind of critical intelligence
it's
to it. It doesn't make it. Yeah.
Really?
It's
and that's the difference.
Well, you see, what I'm really getting at, Pat, is that I think there's a great talent here, and its non-conceptuality can let it die and wither, and there'll be nothing to revive it. I think all of us have ups and downs no matter what we do.
Yeah.
Even when I'm whistling, you know, sometimes the tone is rich and powerful, but the next time I go, I can't get anywhere. But I do think that she has some very fine talent, and I would like to see it conceptualized, probably, in forms which Mike objects to, because in your generation you don't like the discipline of forms.
Well, I think forms, finally, are perhaps more interesting than anything, you know, and more interesting than, and that's what I was saying before, that the song is a form, you know, and it is a distinct form. And the content of the song, I don't think... you can't excerpt the content of the song from the song experience. It just is. You just can't take it out and look at it, you know, because it's not there to see. You know, and it won't stand still, and you can't hold it up to light because it just
you can't see it that way. You know, I can't see it that way. You know, I can't see, I can just respond, and in the case of Laura Nero, respond in a very visceral kind of way.
Well, Pat responds the same way, because he raised Gertrude Stein, and I remember you said in the dressing room when you first came in, well, she's Gertrude Stein.
She's Gertrude Stein.
That's all there is to it. Nothing else.
But that charm of Stein, too.
Yes, yes, I think that's
But it. You have to, I hate to use this word, you have to groove with it, you know, you just... I have that problem occasionally. I like conceptual ideas, but with her, it comes right to me, really. The remembered pain of youth is really, she's talking about the pain of youth.
Right.
That's all she ever talks about. And one remembers it.
Well, I think probably we've, all three of us, spent our share of time in our day talking about the pain of youth. Unfortunately, it wasn't very productive in my case. I would trust that in both your cases it is a good deal more. I do thank you as one who has been the devil's advocate and who looks for understanding, because there is a resistance in those of my years, I think, against the Kermes. I feel I know it a little bit better, and thank you both.
You down, gonna let